funky. Like the beat funky. Nickname Eazy-E, yo, 8-Ball Junkie. Bass drum kicking to show my shit. Rapping, holding my dick, boy. I don't quit. Crowd rocking motherfucker from around the way. I got a six shooter, yo, mean I'm brave. Rolling through the hood to find the boys. Kick dust and cuss, crank up some noise. Police on my draws, I have to pause. 40 ounce in my lap and it's freezing my balls. Freezing my balls. I hook the right turn and let the boys go past. And I say to myself,
so again, this is the Kill Radio 6 p.m. Friday news, brought to you by the IMC, Independent Media Center. And this is killradio.org, internet only. 6 p.m. Friday news. My name is Hassan, with NWA in the background, with Eazy-E from Compton, who is not with us anymore. But, bro, I miss you. I like your voice. And let's see, what I'm going to do today, you guys, I'm going to let me turn Eazy-E down a little bit more. Oh, I can't, turn him down. Hold on. Okay, so I turned Eazy-E down a little bit right there, and, let's see now. What we're going to do today on the Kill Radio News, I'm going to read you this story. Later on in the hour, we're going to listen to some Gore Vidal. He was on a local radio station here Saturday night, and God, do I love Gore Vidal. Oh God, I don't know who I like the best, Gore Vidal or Eazy-E. Those two should someone should put out a compilation of Gore Vidal and Eazy-E. Two true American icons. And you only hear that on Kill Radio in Los Angeles. But anyway, later in the show, we're going to hear a great interview that my buddy Harrison over at 1150 AM did with Gore Vidal. And for those of you that don't know, 1150 AM in Los Angeles is the Air America outlet. But this is something that they did local because Mr. Vidal is living here in Southern California. We're so honored and lucky to have him. Great American hero. He fought in World War II. Cousin of Al Gore, who should be our president right now, as far as I'm concerned, he is. He actually said, my dear cousin Al Gore didn't fight hard enough. Us Gores fight harder. He shouldn't have backed down. So later in the hour, we're going to hear a great interview with Gore Vidal. And right now, I'm going to go into this article from my buddy Steve Lopez, wrote in the LA Times about a week ago after the Oscars. You know, I'm going to read you the article today, and then next week on the 6 p.m. news, I'm going to read you the rebuttal, because I don't think a lot of people liked what Steve said about this movie, Crash. I haven't seen the movie, but it just sounds like rich white liberals with a lot of guilt, you know, who saw a way to make money. Now, you know, maybe I shouldn't be saying that. I haven't seen the film yet, you know. But anyway, it's from the LA Times. Steve Lopez, who's a great writer, Wednesday, March 8th, 2006. And, of course, we all know Crash. I think they won Best Picture this year. So let me start. Steve Lopez points west. He writes, anyway, you guys, Steve has an article in the LA Times maybe twice a week. Steve Lopez points west to Best Picture. The Best Picture misses the big picture, standing cautiously but bravely at the intersection of Beverly and Normandy. I could feel the racial tension in the air. The place was about to blow. A white woman walked into Video Hut, which is run by Koreans, and an Asian man bought flowers from a Guatemalan woman. Given the boiling hatred that pumps through LA's veins, as depicted in the Oscar-winning movie Crash, could ethnic violence be far behind? I used to think we could all get along, more or less. I believe that despite its many flaws and obvious divisions by race and class, Los Angeles was one of the more successfully integrated cities in the world. And to me, Crash, quote-unquote, felt like an artless, dated, and manipulative morality tale on the evils of the sprawling metropolis, shot with a long lens from behind the bars of a gated seaside community. But that was before the all-knowing wizards of the Academy set me straight, choosing, quote-unquote, as the best picture of the year. Could so many Kabbalah and Bagram Yoga practitioners have been wrong, even if it's been years since any of them ventured east of Robinson except to hand out Oscars or cruise for hookers? I think not. All I can figure is that in my own travels across the city, I must have sped past one powder keg after another without seeing the fuses. And so I ventured back out there to see what I could see. Beverly and Normandy, can you get any more L.A. than that? The corner businesses tell the story. Subway, Chinatown, Express, Tokyo, Sushi Academy, Pizza Hut, Chicken Wok, El Chipian, Salvador and Honduran Restaurant, Green Village Acupuncture and Herbs Clinic, Nanuvia, Florbanca, Salvadorian and Guatemalan Restaurant, Yoshinoya, Dr. Julio Goldsman Medical Group, and Pacific Market, owned by a brother and sister from India. As I pulled into the parking lot, Latino, Asian, white, and black patrons were coming and going without apparent incident, but it was early. I got out of my car, looked both ways, and dived for cover when I saw an Asian driver entering the parking lot. Woo! Still in one piece, I spied a suspicious black man standing in the parking lot next to a car. Burglar? Or was it worse? Was he reaching into the glove box for a pistol, planning to knock off Yoshinoya and pistol whip customers for their teriyaki chicken bowls? You know, it's hard out there for a pimp. I walked into Harmonano's Flowers, where Ann Ramirez claimed she has gotten along with her neighbors for 10 years. No problem. A man walked in to say hello. They chatted amicably. He walked away. Quote, unquote, who was that? I asked. A friend of mine. He wasn't Latino, I said. No, he's Japanese. And you get along? Two Latinos walked in after that. Gangbangers? I left the store for my own safety. Kawang Su, 34, was getting into her car when I asked where he lived. Koreatown, he said. He moved there from Korea 10 years ago. And where does he work? South Central L.A., he said. He's got a cell phone shop, and his customers are black and Latino. And against all odds, none of them have attacked each other or beaten him over the head, if you can believe him. At Pacific Market, Mickey, who grew up in India, sells her customers phone cards so they can call home to Guatemala, El Salvador, Mexico, Africa, and the Philippines. Okay, let me turn the page here to page 8. While you hear me shuffling the paper, and bear with me here on the Kill Radio News, 6 p.m. Friday news here at Kill Radio. Okay. Continuing, crash, quote unquote, she asked, and I never heard of it. I saw a white woman walk into Subway and followed her inside to make sure she wasn't mugged. She got a sandwich and made it out okay. Whew. I got a soda, and when the Latino clerk took my money, he said, "Thank you, senor," quote unquote, close quote. Cal Anderson, a black pharmaceutical rep, was visiting the office of Dr. Guzman just upstairs from Subway. Anderson lives in Mid-City, where his nearest neighbors are black, white, and Persian. He's traveled far and wide in the United States and feels more comfortable in Los Angeles than anywhere else. Quote, unquote, you can go where you want, he said. It's a multiracial environment in the city of Los Angeles. You can visit a different country every day, close quote, quote, unquote, close quote. Sure, if you enjoy being carjacked. Nick Shipp, a chef, walked into Dr. Guzman's office for a checkup. Quote, unquote, I love Lucy, close quote, was on TV, and most of the clients were Latino. I pointed out to Shipp that he happens to be white. He shrugged. I mentioned the movie Crash, quote unquote, close quote. My experience in L.A., he said, is the complete opposite. Maybe so, but Lucy and Ricky looked like they were about to have a fight on TV. Those interracial marriages sure are doomed from the moment they cut the cake. As you hear me shaking the paper in the background. In the parking lot, I worked up the nerve to approach the black man standing near the BMW, which he couldn't possibly own. He claimed he was sealing holes in the cloth roof with a silicone gel. What did he take me for, a nitwit? Quote unquote. Where you from? I asked the stranger. Cameroon, George Lewis said, calling himself an accountant and resident of Hollywood. Yes, he said he did see Crash. Quote unquote. You do have problems in Los Angeles, but not as big as that. Quote unquote, close quote. He said, people aren't looking for trouble. They're too busy working and trying to make it. Close quote. Negative media influences are a dark force and a distraction, Lewis said. He frees himself from those influences by focusing on positive energy and trying to live a spiritual life. He shook my hand firmly and gave me a warm gaze, and I felt like Sandra Bullock in Crash, quote unquote. I didn't buy her sudden transformation when she embraced the Latina maid she had repeatedly insulted, but now I can see the truth in it. I realized the black man is not my enemy, but my friend. Thank you, Crash. Thank you, Academy. And again, this is in the LA Times by Steve Lopez. And it came out about a couple of days after the Oscars last week on Wednesday, March 8th, 2006. And Mr. Lopez got a lot of rebuttals to this article. I think a lot of people loved it and a lot of people didn't like it. I think more didn't like it. And I'll read the rebuttal next week. I think you might like it. It's interesting. It's interesting, just as interesting as this one. Okay. So what we're going to do now, let's go back into as we hear the freaking Vermont Boulevard in the background. Let me close the window. Okay, it's live kill radio with someone's car alarm in the background. So let's go back into NWA. I love NWA here on the Kill Radio 6 p.m. Friday news. And in a few minutes, we're going to come up on Mr. Gore Vidal, that great interview. So again, let's go into Eazy-E. Like I said, I miss Eazy-E. And this is Kill Radio, internet only. Give us a call, 213-252-0998. Oh, and you can email me, too. You can email me at HassanJ53@yahoo.com. Okay, HassanJ53@yahoo.com. There's two S's. Hassan, HassanJ53. J53@yahoo.com, and tell me how you like the news. You know, we do the news here every weekday at 6 p.m. We're bringing on another great DJ to do the news on Thursday. He said he doesn't want anybody to know who he is until he starts doing the news, but he's an old newsman from the radio here in Los Angeles in the 80s, and we're lucky to have him at Kill Radio, and he'll be doing the 6 p.m. Thursday Kill Radio news. So listen in, email him, call him. Make him feel good. Make him feel at home here at Kill Radio. And again, our phone number is 213-252-0998. And I'm Hassan. And let's go into Eazy-E. Let's see. I know. Let me get my glasses on here. And I'm going to try and pod up Eazy-E. Let me see. Turn on the... I think I hear... No, wait a minute. 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8. Okay, I'm totally on the wrong track. Okay, here comes Eazy-E right now singing about his 8 ball. What's an 8 ball? I'm 53 years old. Oh, I think that's beer. Here on killradio.org. Let me sing.
monkey. Like the beat funky, nickname Eazy-E, yo, 8-Ball Junkie. Bass drum kicking to show my shit. Rapping, holding my dick, boy. I don't quit, cry, rock the motherfucker from around the way. I got a six shooter, yo, mean I'm brave. Rolling through the hood to find the boys to kick dust and cuss, crank up some noise. Police on my draws, I have to pause. 40 ounce in my lap and it's freezing my balls. Hook the right turn and let the boys go past. Then I say to myself, they can kiss my ass. Hit to get drunk, got the 8 in my lips. Put in the old tape, Marvin Gaye's greatest hits. Turn the shit up, had the bass cold rumpin'. Cruising through the east side, south of Compton. See a big ass, and I say word. I took a look at the face, and the bitch was to the curb. Hold on my tip for the title I'm holding. Eazy-E's fucked up and got the 8-ball rolling.
I was raised in L.A.
Cruising down the street in my 6-4.
Posse.
Riding on sloths, looking for Chris, y'all. Mexican almost wrecked my shit. Flipped his ass off, put him to the floor. Bottle was empty, so I went to the store.
They killing me. They do the dog, y'all. Dr. Funkenstein's here. Better known as George Clinton. Tail ain't nothing but a long booty. Kill radio. They're killing me.
I want you to hit it.
Dr. Funkenstein's here. Better known as George Clinton. Tail ain't nothing but a long booty. Kill radio. They're killing me.
Residence of Mr. Vidal. Gore Vidal is a novelist, an essayist, a playwright, a provocateur, an American master who's written 7 novels about American history, along with the well-known satirical novels like Myra Breckinridge and Duluth. Gore Vidal has also written dozens of television plays, film scripts, even 3 mystery novels, all under a pseudonym. Gore has also written well over 100 essays. He's written a memoir with another forthcoming and is known for his easy familiarity with the world of politics and of letters, for his urbane wit, and supreme self-confidence as a writer and a humorist. Gore Vidal, I want to thank you for letting me slide in front of the fireplace with you here in your inner sanctum. Well, in this world of what seems to be a cultural impropriety, where we see politics at the apex of insanity, where the old joke about the monkeys running the madhouse, except that in the White House, one even has a simian structure, I can say that we're all very excited to be able to talk to you, Mr. Vidal, about the state of the world, this long war that we've been entrenched in, and, I think the future just, it has to get better, right?
Well, I certainly hope so. I met, what was his name, Blitzen or something, the Swedish,
Hans Blix?
Yeah. Last year, and I was making a tour of Sweden, and there we were for a couple of days at this kind of festival. And he was so funny, particularly about dealing with American officialdom. They want to know the whole truth about everything and then suppress it. So he was couldn't have been funnier.
I know, even Nixon, that sort of gargoyle Ed Sullivan hunched over, has so much more appeal than Swingin' Dick Cheney, the S&M vice president, the Torquemada of the new millennium.
Oh, yes. This gang is very, very peculiar. And most Americans, by and large, don't pay much attention to politics until they're being shot at or their money is taken away from them. They're beginning slowly to wake up that this gang doesn't know how to govern, doesn't care about governing. More and more stuff is coming out about Katrina. That, yes, Bush was told that the levees were breaking, that this was a great catastrophe. He doesn't do anything. He continues his vacation in Crawford, Texas.
Then got a lovely tan.
Well, max factor 25, yes, of course. It's got a great makeup artist. It's they can't do anything about the brain. You can't get facts into it. It's just so weird. He knows nothing, alas.
You imagine, for all the books that you've written and the novels and the essays and all of this, it seems to me that you do this at your own peril. It's like, how does this guy not get shot or wiped out or disappeared? I mean, this is an extraordinary volume of work you've put out that tells us so much, so much.
How do you know that you're not talking to a replacement for me? You have no way of knowing whether I'm I.
Because they don't want cloning and stem cell research.
That slowed us down at the beginning, but you know, so I have no knees. But I'm not quite complete yet. But as a Cheneyite monster, like I think of him as Dr. Frankenstein, you know, inventing people all the time. Perhaps I'm one of his inventions. I'll soon find out. The second I step into a church, I am restored to my original self.
Or you might immolate, right?
I might indeed, yes.
Harrison here with you, visiting with Gore Vidal about the almost science fiction-like political essence of today. Mr. Vidal, when you reference Dick Cheney, I hear thousands in the audience cringing at the spectacle of this hunched-over menace, wire glasses sagging down his prolapsed face, this avaricious purveyor of death darkly giggling at more monstrous things to come. So let me ask you, what do you make of a guy who makes no eye contact when he's giving an interview or making a speech? What would you think of someone who avoids all eye contact and, like, stares at the floor or at his hands every time he answers a direct question? What do you think?
You would think that they don't like you and do not want to talk to you, and they are suffering a great deal at your presence, close to their presence. It was a marvelous imitation of him the other night on Jon Stewart, when he's taking off his explanation of how he shot the lawyer, or the lawyer threw himself in front of his gun, you know, because he wanted to be shot by the vice president. And so this guy's
imitating. Quite a leap, isn't it?
I should think.
30 feet.
And this guy's imitating the voice of Cheney. And he said, thank you. And that's exactly how he sounded on the tape, you know. Just, you weren't going to get a word clearly out of him. No, this is a very spooky time. And I hope we get out of it alive. But looking at Bush in India, just been watching that, and here he is giving them all sorts of advanced atomic weaponry, which they will obviously use one day. I don't think against us, but certainly against Pakistan. And Bush says cheerily, anyway, we're getting to like, I'm wartime president, we're getting to like mangoes. We're getting, Mr. Prime Minister, we like mangoes in America. That's the quid pro quo for making them a nuclear power. I do not think this is perhaps in the best interest of the country, but, you know, who can tell?
Or planet Earth. I mean, wherever this guy travels, people rise up in hordes and burn things in effigy and scream and wail, arms flailing in wild histrionics. They're clearly not happy with this guy, except in the United States, where he's funny, he's nice, I'd like to have a beer with him.
So he's down to 36%.
IQ?
No, that's his high point. That was, you know... That was when he was a cheerleader at Andover. And because you're at Andover, you get 6 extra points, even if you can't remember the cheers, you know. No, he's the least... people want to call him stupid. Well, he's not stupid in the normal sense. But he's the least educated president. Not that I think much of education in America, but... He never reads a book. He doesn't read the media, which he may be wise there. But he doesn't know anything. And he isn't interested. That is what comes over. There's never been a president that you couldn't explain anything to him. Apparently, it was being explained to him in Louisiana that the levees were breaking. And he's just staring straight ahead, you know, as though he was doing brush in Crawford, Texas. Well, I'm a wartime president, which means I can do anything I want. I'm above the law. That's what a wartime president is. Nobody, because we don't have a free press, we don't have anything in the way of information, no one has pointed out to him you cannot have a wartime presidency without a war. There is no war. And you can't pretend that 9/11 is an act of war. It could be if it was connected with a country. So they pretend is it connected with Afghanistan or Iraq. No proof of any kind. It wasn't. They wanted to invade because they were after the oil. What do oil men want? They want the oil reserves of Iraq. They want the pipeline that is supposed to be going to Afghanistan. So it's all a business deal for them. So they just invent any lie, knowing that there is no media that will question their lies. The media is tied in with the ownership of the country, and which is tied in with the oil and gas business, and which is tied in with the current Republican Party, which does not at all resemble the respectable Republican Party of my youth. It's just so different. I can't imagine what the Republicans of that day would think of these hoods.
I remember when I was a little kid, my mother was in junior league, and it was the party of noblesse oblige. At least you aspired to that. You wanted to give back. You helped the people through church or Planned Parenthood, things of that nature. And now it's just, it really is greed. It's about having a one-party system. It almost feels like the Supreme Soviet. They all stand up at the same time and clap, no matter what's being said.
Well, they are Pavlovian in their responses. And it's never been as bad as this. I know other generations have said that, but never before have we had a president who says that he can do a preemptive war whenever he feels like it. He can turn on Denmark and say, I know that three terrorists are living there. I'm afraid we're now at war with Denmark, and we will be landing troops to search Copenhagen. He believes this, and he has said as much in the past. He said as much when he got ready to go into Iraq, a country that had done us no harm and could do us no harm, and no matter what future you might have thought up for them. Ditto Afghanistan. Now he's been desperately trying to strike at Syria, but so far we've run out of money, so we don't have the money for yet another war there. Now he's getting ready for Iran, on no grounds at all, that they might get atomic weapons. Well, so what? We don't mind that Israel has them. We don't mind that other countries, China must have them. There are several other countries have that we don't fuss about. Well, we don't fuss about it. If I had the United States as an enemy, I'd have atomic weapons in 5 minutes. What else could hold these maniacs at bay? After all, we're the only country that ever used them, who had them. We're the only ones against the Japanese who had been trying for 4 months to surrender. And Truman, by then the president, alas, Truman was getting messages from the emperor asking to surrender. Because Harry Truman wanted to frighten Stalin and say, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming, the Russians are coming. He blew up Nagasaki and he blew up Hiroshima. And you know that everything, this is something, of course, we'll never read in the papers, or the schools won't teach it. Every major military commander in the United States, starting with Eisenhower in Europe and Admiral Nimitz in the Pacific, begged Harry Truman not to drop the atomic bombs, that they were not needed, that Japan was defeated, Tokyo no longer existed. But no, we had to show off. We had to scare Stalin because he was the new enemy, he's the new Hitler.
Kind of like the mafia, right? You go break the guy's kneecaps and everyone in the neighborhood hears about it, and you don't screw then with the bosses.
No, you don't. That's exactly the real politic that went on at that time. This is Gore Vidal, and you're listening to me chatting away on Harrison on the Edge.
Harris Lang might appear like huge conspiracies or secrets to a greater population that's weaned on a steady diet of the nightly news or the Cartoon Network.
They're not secrets that I reveal. They're all part of history. But they're not supposed to be mentioned. So you've always got somebody who says, that's not true. 1 million Americans would have been killed. Well, I was one of the 13 million men who were in the Army in the Second World War, and I was in the Pacific. I certainly believe the propaganda because we had no information other than what the government was feeding us as soldiers. And we had been assured that 1 million of us would die in the invasion of Japan. So I must confess that when the atomic bombs dropped, I thought, well, that saves me. I won't have to be in the invasion. Then, of course, I get back. My father's a West Pointer. My uncle's a West Pointer. My stepbrother's a West Pointer. And I learn immediately. They're at the heart of the Air Force, heart of the B-29s, which had destroyed Japan pretty much. And they said, no, the war's been over for some time now. These are politicians trying to frighten people. And so they were. Well, just think if that was going on then about something major, what can be going on now that we're not told?
Right, and if we think mathematically, Bush has more time in office to go than Kennedy did during his entire presidency.
I know, and Kennedy at least had the grace not to do much more than make two goofs, one in the Bay of Pigs and the other in Vietnam. But his nature was, I don't think he would have continued in error. This guy just revels. He doesn't know what an error is. He just thinks if he says something, it's true.
It's like sovereign immunity, right? The king can do no wrong. It is so because I say so.
That's been his attitude, yes. Well, you see, he's got all these lousy lawyers around him, and they have convinced him that Abraham Lincoln and Franklin Roosevelt misused presidential powers, but perhaps so harassed the France. Great wars to conduct. Well, so they did. But simultaneously, they didn't do anything that did not have a legal basis.
And most lawyers, of course, would agree wholeheartedly with that. Harrison here with you, sitting in front of the glowing fireplace at the home of Gore Vidal, examining the many levels of naughtiness exuding out of our federal government. This is Harrison on the Edge on LA's Progressive Voice, AM 1150. Mr. Vidal, with what appears now to be several years of warrantless spying on average Americans, at the specific direction of the White House, by the way, we're told it's somehow all legal, simply because they declare it to be so.
One of the pieces of nonsense that the White House puts out all the time, well, you see, we don't have to have warrants for spying on Americans because terrorism is everywhere. And the president's commander-in-chief has inherent powers. He does not. He has enumerated powers in the Constitution. They're all listed. He doesn't have any powers beyond that. The fact that Lincoln overstepped the line a couple of times, that Franklin Roosevelt did, with habeas corpus, First Amendment as well, and ditto Franklin Roosevelt, they did it with great, great care, trying to follow every possible legal form to justify what they were doing. And after all, Lincoln was, you know, the Capitol was surrounded by the Confederate Army. And Baltimore was about to go out of the Union, and Lincoln is desperately trying to get troops from the North. The Northern governors didn't want to send him anything. So he's rather hysterical, and so he just said, okay. And he threatened Baltimore. And they said, we're going out of the Union, and the mayor said this, the mayor said that. Lincoln said, all right, I'll burn Baltimore to the ground. As it's not quoted very often, particularly not in Maryland politics.
It doesn't excite you. My family comes from the Eastern Shore. I'm sure it's an unthrilling concept.
Well, it's bad enough they killed all the oysters. Not Lincoln,
right.
The Marylanders.
Well, and growing up as a little boy, you had so much free access to Washington, D.C. You were helping your grandfather and doing all these amazing things, and you really had a chance, or I would say you chose to step in and look at the inner sanctums and observe power and watch the structure of things, and what an extraordinary thing to do.
I was fascinated, of course. I lived until I was 10 with my grandfather, and until 17 I was away in school mostly, and 17 I was in the Army in the Pacific. So my only home life was with Senator Gore, who was a blind man, and I read to him. And I'd take him to the Senate cloakroom, and he would sit there, and the senators would all come around and gossip, and my ears were flapping. I learned, I think, a good deal, or at least I heard a good deal. No, I'm a child of D.C. and a child of politics. And, of course, it was 1940 was the crucial year in our history, which is when it was decided that we would go into World War II by President Roosevelt. But the people didn't want to go. So Roosevelt had to find ways of stimulating them into a wartime mood, which the Japanese solved by attacking Pearl Harbor. But one knew what was happening, and one knew who was plotting, and one knew. We had, I think there were 8,000 British Secret Service people in D.C., Mr. Orr came to Merrillwood, Mr. Auchincloss and my mother, the then Mrs. Auchincloss. They had a great house. And, I met more Brits then that I went on knowing for the rest of my life. And they were all there to propagandize us and to get us into the war. And they were working over all the isolationist senators. And they were brilliant, too. It was the first set of brilliant people that I ever got to meet. We had brilliant American senators and so on, but they tended to be a little on the slow side, and they were kind of not very quick to rise, as it were, to the bait, to conversation. The Brits were just, you know, every last one was Oscar Wilde when it came to using the language.
Right.
They were very sharp. And I made many friends there as a kid that I went right on knowing for the next 50 years. Now, alas, mostly tucked away.
Before we started talking here this afternoon, I told you a little bit about a Greek guy I'd gone canoeing with and all of that. And I just wanted to acknowledge also that after reading your memoirs, the Palimpsest, am I pronouncing that correctly?
Yeah.
I learned a whole lot about your process in becoming congruent with your nature. Everyone has to, sooner or later, whatever that is for everybody. But it really helped me make some big decisions to actually become a whole human being. And there are so many millions whom you will never meet, but who love you dearly, who you've helped on that level, not just offering intellectual information for others, but there are so many people on a human level for whom you have been such a great giver. So I just want to offer you an unsolicited compliment for that, because I probably wouldn't be here right now had I not jumped off the high dive into my own life.
Have a good swim. I have an irritable nature, and I didn't like certain attitudes that were abroad in the army and in the press, in American life. And the fuss over sex just seemed to me, there was enough trouble, and the real trouble in the world, without going into that. So I decided it was either to run for Congress or to write The City and the Pillar. And I thought, there are plenty of congressmen, and they don't add up to very much, but such a book might be useful. And anyway, I felt honor-bound to do it, and I did it, and, you know, you pay a certain price, but I was never terribly interested in other people's opinion of me, and I thought they should be interested in my opinion of them.
Well, they are, that's for sure.
Which I'm fairly quick to express. So, je ne regret rien. As Edith Piaf used to say, je ne regrette pas rien.
I actually happen to have a couple of 78s with her singing on it, and I play them occasionally on my wind-up Victrola, which seems to add to the overall cacophony of her art form, but it certainly makes it very interesting indeed. Harrison here with you on this special one-on-one with novelist, essayist, playwright, and political provocateur Gore Vidal. Whether it's the dozens of television plays, film scripts, or his memoir, or the hundreds of essays, Gore Vidal is internationally known for his urbane wit and psycho-political prowess. You know, I was thinking virtually everything of value or ruminated in the form of human thought can be found in your endless writings and musings, and somehow you're able to touch so many people despite the often icky subject matter we're faced with in our daily lives. I can honestly say not everybody could put a flashlight on poop and get other people to look, especially when they know it ain't pretty. So I'm guessing it's your delivery mechanism that makes the roller coaster ride through your personal lens so palatable.
You must remember, I always thought of life as a comedy. So I don't strike the tragic note very often. I mean, this administration is pretty tragic for the country, but at the same time, they're so wildly funny. I mean, just the voice of Cheney and the honking like a goose or Bush. Wartime president. So sad, he doesn't even know what it means, you know. I mean, these are people operating without any information. He doesn't know where anything is. He doesn't know what warrants are, from judicial warrants to a search.
I've got a couple of chums around the White House who say, you know, his drinking is so out of control again, and that Laura's now staying at the Mayflower Hotel a lot. She's gaining weight because she's miserable. She's smoking cigarettes.
This great nation will lead the world, and we will be successful.
No, you won't. You certainly will not be successful, you idiot. I told you not to say that in public. And here you go babbling away. Yes, again, that was a George W. Bush doll that I just played on the air for the delectation of your listeners.
It's a pity that it's not soft enough to drive pins into.
He's a great hero, a great statesman.
And a wartime president. We're very blessed about that.
A wartime president. But I think we should all, now that if he's back to drinking again, I think we should all send him a bottle of bourbon. He'll be happier. He'll stay out of our way. He'll spend more time on the ranch clearing brush, as they call it. There he's clearing brush. You know it's the cocktail hour.
Do you know, I think we could seriously get possibly millions of cases of liquor. Easily, people would be more than thrilled to drive it in their personal automobiles and dump it off on the White House lawn, and he would be so busy and happy.
I believe in making people happy, because then they don't make you unhappy. They're too busy with their own joy.
There was, I think it was probably about a year ago, maybe, you were at Harvard giving a speech, and somebody said, Mr. Vidal, through all the people you've met in your life and all the experiences you've had, I want to be a TV anchor. I want to report the news on TV. Can you give me, out of all your learnings, one piece of information, the one piece of advice that's going to help advance my career? And you said something along the lines of, I suggest you take a course in hair and makeup.
Did I say that? Yeah.
It was brilliant.
Well, that was getting to the heart of the matter. Well, he probably did, and he's probably on air now.
Yep, no doubt. Mr. Gore Vidal, and you are now an official Harrison Hellraiser.
Lock it in. Coming up, more Harrison on the Edge on LA's Progressive.
Okay, is everyone out there? I can't believe I got back right in time. I had to leave the studio for a few minutes, and I'm back here right on time. And thank you, Mr. Gore Vidal and Mr. Harrison. I love both of you guys. Harrison does a great local show here in Los Angeles, and he was interviewing Gore Vidal, and treasure that. Gore Vidal's getting up there in age. He's getting older, but it seems like he's getting more wittier and more, you know, I love to listen to that man. He wrote the great book, Myra Breckinridge, and so much more stuff, you know. All you young people out there, check out Gore Vidal. He's a great thinker, one of the last great American thinkers, you know. And when he comes down on this current administration, that's when it gets scary, because he's a historian too. He calls himself a historian, and who's going to argue with Gore Vidal? And you can tell, you know, by what he says that he knows what he's talking about. I mean, I love the line he says: "The only time Americans get political is when people are shooting at him, or when their money's being taken away," which is so true, which is so fucking true. So again, this is the Cure Radio 6 p.m. Friday News. I'll see you next week, where I'll read you rebuttals to Steve Lopez's great commentary on the film Crash. And signing off here for Xenophone, we'll be coming up at the 7 o'clock hour. You guys have a good weekend. This is the 6 p.m. Friday News, signing off. And let's go out with a little... Milt, the great late Milt Jackson on Vibes. And again, my name is Hassan, and this is Kill Radio 6 p.m. News. Thanks for listening. Tell a friend.